gizmo rose out of the box. Every ovary in the audience vibrated like one of those egg stones in Temple of Doom, which also came out the same year and was a Spielberg movie, and also had an Asian boy with a baseball cap in it. Mm-hmm. I'm connecting everything. But all the ovaries began glowing white hot. Sometimes he's a Mogwai, but sometimes he's a gremlin. But I love both sides of it.
But I see the Mogwai within.
And we're back.
Hi!
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Crowded Theater Podcast. As always, I am Kyle.
I'm Taylor.
And I am Cliff.
That's right. This is The Crowded Theater Podcast, the only podcast where... the only movie podcast, I should say, where all movies are seen in theaters, no DVDs, no streaming. We see them with our community, among the people, Cliff, where we belong. We are populist podcasters, if nothing else.
Can't you see by the hat?
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. You're kind of like Joe the Plumber. Which is why you're wearing a street trash shirt right now, where someone is being flushed down a toilet.
Mm-hmm,
there we go. No, we...
Loose connection to Gremlins, admittedly, on that one.
Yes.
But still something.
Yes, I agree. They're both gooey films where people melt.
That's about the closest
and
thing
very,
I got.
And very New York-y films as well. Mm-hmm, I would say that, because mm-hmm, street trash is definitely a very New York-y horror film, and Gremlins, you know, the Chinatown stuff, all that stuff, very, very...
sort of based on urban legend, you know, what happened if you drink the 50-year-old hooch hidden in the wall, is it gonna turn you into a melty goo monster in that movie? Yes, likewise in Gremlins.
And if there's one thing that makes street trash perhaps more niche than Gremlins in its appeal, I would say it's the scene where they play football with a severed penis. That is definitely the scene, I would say. Now, which is interesting, because Joe Dante actually shot a scene for Gremlins where they played football with a severed penis, but they ended up leaving it on the cutting room floor to include Phoebe Cates' monologue. None of this is true, by the way, Taylor.
Okay.
Except for the part where they play football with a severed penis in street trash, that actually does happen.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
cool. Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
that's
yeah. Mm-hmm. And Taylor, do you recall that this that street trash and the scene where they play football with a severed penis is, in fact, a critical part of the origin story of our relationship?
I wanted to bring that up. I didn't know if it felt too much like a girlfriend to be like, by the way.
No,
but just one of our very first conversations via Tinder was that he was watching Street Trash with his brother that was over at the night.
Yes, that's right. And I believe I was messaging you about the fact that I was watching a movie called Street Trash.
And we were watching Donnie Darko followed by Mamma Mia at our house.
Go. Yeah, that's right. And I remember saying, you probably shouldn't watch Street Trash. I was like, oh, cool. Do you recommend it? I was like, not for you.
No, actually.
And then I met you, and you still haven't seen Street Trash. And I think that's probably for the best. But we'll see. We'll eventually... I'll tell you what, Cliff. If one day that Street Trash is playing in a crowded theater, then we will see
Street
Trash.
That would be funny. That would be a full circle.
Then we will know the moment has finally arrived when the planets have aligned thusly. Anyhoozle, the film for today is not Street Trash, but another very, very gooey film and a Christmas film. Oh, Cliff, quick, grab one of those light necklaces. We forgot to put one of those on, and the gizmo mask. You see, as Cliff grabs props, there's props in this podcast, and the reason there's props is because we went to a Gremlins, the 1984 Joe Dante film, Gremlins Movie Party at the Alamo Drafthouse, and Cliff is now retrieving a necklace of Christmas lights and a gizmo mask, Gizmo the Mogwai, and 3D glasses, which, humorously, they informed us, the host informed us as we entered the theater that, yes, the film was not, in fact, a 3D film, but... they handed out 3D glasses because the gremlins within the film used the 3D glasses while watching Snow White, which is another fun, interesting thing if we were to recall our experience chronologically of seeing Gremlins in the theater over the weekend. There you go. Perfect. Right on the succulent. The succulent is now a Mogwai.
We're going to take this first for just a second, y'all.
There you
and
go.
Go
there
to.
Taylor has now masked the succulent.
Just out of frame.
There you go. Well, it's in that one over there.
There
you go.
Yeah.
Perfect. Anyway, so a movie party, for those of you who don't live in Austin and go to Alamo, is essentially just a special screening where they have a host. They soften the policies on not talking so people can kind of quote along. In fact, I believe the movie parties are a derivation of an old Alamo tradition called the quote alongs, which that came from the then sing alongs before that, and blah, 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 blah. But now they just call the movie parties and they hand out fun props. We've been to a Pulp Fiction movie party before, but
we've gone to a Big Lebowski movie party before.
Yes, we have. Yeah, and so they gave out felt masks of both Gizmo and Spike, the main gremlin. They gave us these
because you can be naughty
props.
Or nice. There's yes. a little naughty and nice in everybody.
So and
very
really,
cute.
Yeah, really the perfect thing for the Crowded Theater podcast because mm-hmm. it was a special way of seeing gremlins with a bunch of people all wearing Christmas lights, just like the dog suspended from the porch.
Yes.
In the movie and
yes,
and there you go. And Taylor is adjusting her Christmas lights.
Let's see. There's like those different settings.
Yes, you have the blinky setting on now. I think that's
there
I think
we go.
I think blinky is probably best for gremlins because everything's short circuiting in that movie. Don't you say
it's
you know?
Just a little
should there you go?
Yeah,
see
we'll go
now
with the slower one.
Now it looks like there's a gremlin in the lights.
Oh yes, and then also shout out to the gremlin sweater real fast just uh-huh. to kind of show off his.
Oh yeah,
cool.
Taylor's wearing a
gremlin
sweater.
I'm gonna show it to this camera with all of the woven gremlins.
Yes.
And my favorite aspect is where are they? The tiny chicken wings. There they are. The chicken wings.
Oh yes, they're actually into the Christmas-like pattern of the thing. They have woven water drops and drumsticks as the Christmas pattern. Of course, don't let them touch water and do not feed them after midnight as they're fed with drumsticks. That's a pretty impressive sweatshirt, I must say. The popcorn mask, etc. So you get a lot of comments on the sweater as you actually wear it in the Christmas season behind your desk at work, etc.
Yes, at my office job.
Yes, yes. So and what kind of comments do you get on
it? Everybody loves it. You know, young and small. I feel like it's one of those movies that
young and old, short and tall,
thin and stout, and
you get a lot of comments on your sweatshirt.
Everyone loves
like
it, and everyone can kind of tell the little bits, and then you kind of people who are like get surprised, like, is that a gremlin sweater? And it is.
Yeah.
It is a gremlin sweater.
Yeah.
Great stuff.
And it is a great, and so part of the reason we're obviously, I think it's festive and appropriate to have a Christmas sweater of gremlins is, of course, the fact that it is a fantastic Christmas movie. It was playing as part of Christmas season.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're hopefully going to get this episode out here before Christmas is over. And I don't know, Taylor, did it get you in the Christmas spirit?
It got me in the Christmas spirit. I always like a good cold movie, and anything without snow in it feels pretty Christmassy, let alone the fact that it actually is around Christmas time
mm-hmm.
and have the whole, like, you know, lights situation with the dog,
yeah. Definitely having the whole audience in Christmas lights added something special.
The carolers. It is a Christmas movie.
Yeah, and this is a movie that we've all seen before. Cliff and I watched this quite a bit growing up because it was Gremlins and we were born. You were born mm-hmm. in 83. I was born in 85.
Yep. I'm
so
young enough to remember my mother disapproving of us potentially watching Gremlins.
That's funny.
Because people said it was a kid's movie, but it's not a kid's movie. It's not appropriate for kids.
That's funny.
I never remember that deep in the past.
That's interesting. I do not remember the first time I saw this film. I never remember a time having not seen it. So, yeah, it was definitely one of those tapes, I think, that we just grew up with, probably recorded off of TV, mm-hmm. and watched a hell of a lot of times. And I am old enough to remember as well, though, coming into the world during the phenomenon of the suction cup gizmos in everyone's windows. There were little suction cup dolls. Gizmos were everywhere. There were little gremlin dolls.
Bring those back.
I know. We could probably find one. It would be very expensive. Someone's got to be making that now. Everyone's licensing stuff. But I remember seeing little gizmos.
The Chinese ripoff with 3 ears.
That's mm-hmm. right. Exactly. Gremlins. Fun screening. Really cool to see it with an audience.
Full theater.
Yeah, full theater. I think one of the cool things that before we kind of dive into the movie itself, they had a cool host whose name I don't remember who pointed out that she was of the age where Gizmo was really starting to get to her, which I think primed the audience in a really wonderful way for Gizmo's first appearance on screen, where you could just feel the collective coming from everyone. I think I was sort of had an angled view because we were at, I think, the Alamo Mueller, where they have those little small tables of some people who had brought kids, plenty of kids in the screening as well. And I don't think any moment got as much of a collective reaction, an audible reaction from the audience as the cute Gizmo moments throughout the thing. So, Taylor, how was Gizmo on the big screen?
Gizmo was fantastic. Honestly, I think the first time that we saw this movie, we were actually in our living room, and I remember just having a very emotional reaction to the Gizmo the whole time.
Yes.
And
you do not like it when Gizmo is in peril.
I did not and do not like when Gizmo is in peril. I think my least favorite scene is when he is in the bar scene when he's tied up to the darts.
Oh,
no,
yeah,
no,
yeah, yeah,
no. take him down, hold him.
That's funny.
No, Gizmo is fantastic. Yeah, 10 out of 10 character.
Awesome. Yeah, no, Gizmo obviously was a big hit, but the whole movie just plays like gangbusters to this day, and it's just, again, very exciting,
no
very
dull
fun.
Moments.
No dull moments in Gremlins. But so Gremlins, Cliff, Gremlins, Taylor, a movie we've all seen before, a beloved classic, something though that certainly stands the test of time in the sense that Taylor is still getting positive comments on her Gremlins sweater to this day, something that thoroughly penetrated the zeitgeist. You know, before there was Baby Groot, there was Gizmo.
Yeah, and before Baby Yoda, there was Gizmo.
Exactly.
Baby Yoda really just is a Gizmo ripoff, just less hair.
Yes. It's green. It's a Gremlins-Gizmo combo.
Well, that's sort of an interesting thing, because we're now talking about Gremlins, we're talking about Gizmo, or these things being knocked offs of Gizmo, but to kind of begin at the beginning with Gremlins, I mean, Gremlins came out in 1984, 1 year after E.T., and so it was produced by Steven Spielberg, who had just made all the money in the world by making what was originally going to be, I forget what it was going to be called, like Dark Skies or something like that, but it was originally going to be a darker, more spooky, horror-oriented movie, alien movie, that then turned into just kids falling in love with an adorable, large-eyed alien. And then that became the whole fucking movie, and made a bajillion dollars. It was the top grossing film at the time to date. I don't recall. Anyway, but it was right up there. So then this is Spielberg finding a script by a young Chris Columbus, who would go on to direct Home Alone, which actually, funny enough, we might, in a kind of Kevin Bacon-y game chain of events, might see Home Alone next week, because he's playing at the Paramount Theater, which would be an awesome, fantastic way to see Home Alone, hopefully with big audience, etc. Anyway, good Christmas movie, so TBD on all of that. Chris Columbus would go on to direct the first two Harry Potter films as well, so he made quite a big impression on the world. But at the time, I think he said he was like living in a shitty apartment in like Manhattan and writing the script inspired because it was infested with mice and rats like that were like nibbling on his fingers, and he's like, small things are scary, and so he wrote a horror movie, Gremlins, that was much darker, where the gremlins are really eating people, and felt sounded a lot more similar to Critters, which is another, being Texans, we do love Critters, and we will talk about Critters and Critters 2 perhaps a little bit more later on, but where they were, you know, eating people and, you know, whatever. But this script was read and acquired by Steven Spielberg's Amblin Entertainment, coming off of E.T., new company, wanted to make all the money in the world, and I'm sure they saw this fucking script and were like, it's got a big, cute thing with big, wide set, fucking sparkly eyes, and then we're gonna have some zany shit, maybe Spielberg exercising some of the darkness that wasn't present in E.T., you know, with the aliens being potentially bad and all of that. And so this is a film that in so many ways could culturally just have been viewed, if it were not successful, if it did not have its own energy, could have been viewed as a sort of you know, non-science fiction, more horror-y knockoff, but lesser than version of E.T., you know? In fact, when we were looking a little bit into the film prior to this, they were talking about how even the art for the poster was inspired by E.T.'s art, E.T.'s poster, which somewhat accounted for, you know, it taking a moment, a couple weeks for the film to catch on, etc. And it opened the same day as Ghostbusters also, so that's another reason why maybe it made more money the second weekend. Anyway, but it's interesting to look at all these films inspired by Gizmo and yet realizing that Gizmo is drafting off of the energy of E.T. coming 1 year later, and yet in that same way Spielberg sort of seemed to coach the whole idea of the movie as its producer into something far more family friendly, and was the one who ended up turning because in the original script, and a fun fact before we kind of dive into what it is, Gizmo ultimately becomes Spike at the end. Gizmo was turns into the gremlin, and he fights Gizmo at the end in the thing. And that was sort of the tragic. But again, the creatures are only superficially look cute, but in fact are all bad.
Yeah.
And indeed, as a fun fact, we learn watching special features that Mogwai apparently is Chris Columbus looked up Chinese mythology and stuff, and Mogwai Jedi means devil.
Yes, yes, exactly.
So, yes. So not meant to be nice at all.
Cute anticipation of the idea that these things would all turn out bad, and Spielberg is like, where's the fucking E.T.? We need something cute and cuddly that kids are going to buy dolls of.
Thank gosh.
And boy, and honestly, again, quite brilliantly, that heart that went through the thing of adorable Gizmo, the fact that that's not betrayed by the film, that Gizmo, even again in a way that sort of seems to stand in mild contradiction, or at least in, you know, perpendicular relationship to all of the other gremlins. It's like, so does Gizmo become a gremlin? Like, even I remember being a kid and being confused about it, but it doesn't matter because the emotional truth of wanting Gizmo to be good, I think, overrides.
Oh, yeah. And I think ultimately it works as an integrated whole. Actually, Gizmo being good and the other ones being bad works as the ties in with the thematic motifs of all the other symbology of the movie, which we will get into in a smidge.
Well, that's another thing about this screening that was cool, to talk about the origins of Gremlins, and all, which kind of connects into some of, I think, some of the fun subtext of the script in the movie about technology and modernity and all that stuff, is that they played at this screening at the Alamo the original Warner Brothers Bugs Bunny short, where he is, where the, we all watched it, where the plane is attacked by Gremlins, and
Chris yeah, 1943 Columbus. Short yeah, yeah. during WWII.
Exactly, exactly. So the idea the of a gremlin being kind of a little gremlin in the machine, causing all the machine, the idea that emerges during World War II of gremlins in the engines and things that disrupt that you know, basically is a fun way to refer to just the chaos, the of randomness that eventually little things will get in and fuck stuff up. Chris Columbus said his father used the term gremlins to refer when fixing his car and stuff like that, connects it all the way through to then him naming these little creatures gremlins. But what I like about this, I'm sure this is present, I'm sure, in the original script, and it certainly comes through in the finished film, is how much they carry the subtext of gremlins and technology being frustration.
Yes,
I mean, literally, Gizmo's name being Gizmo, the fact that the father is an inventor, the fact that every invention doesn't fucking work.
Well, let's get into it. Because one, take it back to the original symbology in WWII, you know, why were all the planes failing and crashing? Yeah. Well, they weren't failing because of gremlins. They were failing because the U.S. was having to mass produce a whole bunch of cheap and defective machines that many of them would, you know, crash and fail and kill a lot of folks and all that, and just attributing that to gremlins. They are the spirit of cheap, mass-produced things that don't work. And of course, what is the father into? He is pursuing the American dream, but his particular dream is to come up with the next cheap, mass-produced thing that doesn't work that'll make him super rich. And he is contrasted with, when he shows up at the Chinese shop is filled with old things, traditional things, things which have stood the test of time, things which have a history to them and a tradition to them and which last, all of that. These are the big contrast between the traditional world and the maladies of Americans and modern society.
And again, I think also just because that works on, because it works on that level, why the film begins with the father, played by Hoyt Axton, just needs a really unique gift. And there's even, I think, a deleted scene, you know, that we watched from the film where prior to that, he goes to a different store that's selling items of technology, boom boxes and various other doohickeys. And he says, no, I want something that is really unique. And of course, what is the character of things that are mass produced? They are not unique. And that's sort of, and we begin in this world where if you want something unique, you have to go to a pre-industrial world. You have to go to a world that exists prior to all of the doohickey that and gizmos that completely define the father's ambitions and the world. And then we even, with the kind of backlot town of Kingston Falls, where, and I think that, again, there's more deleted scenes in the movie that make this subtext more explicit, where, like, the bank is trying to take over the town and sell it to high-tox chemicals, which is why Judge Reinhold shows up in the first scene of the movie, which always bothered me when I was a kid, that, like, Billy, the other Billy, not the Billy from this movie, but the Billy from Beverly Hills Cop is in one scene and never comes back for the rest of the movie.
He's in two scenes.
But the remainder of his scenes kind of continue to further that subtext of the town itself being corrupted by doohickey and technology because everyone's houses
and
are
greed and money and materialism.
Exactly. So, but to not lose to not lose track of where we were in the screening, what I think is fucking cool about all that stuff is it's a really interesting elaboration on the idea that begins in this Bugs Bunny cartoon. And we got the chance to see the Bugs mm-hmm. Bunny cartoon, which is, again, literally midstream, being created during World War II, where Bugs is trying to get into a military plane. He's reading a book. I forget exactly how we get into it, but he's essentially warned about gremlins. A tiny gremlin with big ears mm-hmm. shows up, looks very different from the gremlins in the film, and begins to try and detonate a bomb by hitting it, takes him up in a plane, and basically Bugs Bunny gets tossed around for a while by all kinds of malfunctioning technology, It is a fun. It almost feels more like a Sylvester cartoon, you know, like a Tweety and Sylvester or something like that. Small bird, small mouse, Tom and Jerry's fucking mm-hmm. with this bigger thing, but very funny little thing. And you can see that, okay, what do you do with such a goofy, silly idea like that? And to take it to the level, and you know, of using that as the jumping off point for not only this wild ride of a movie with lots of gremlins and as a literalized creepy crawly critter in a monster movie, but as this wonderful satirical subtext for, I'm sure, what was becoming, certainly it was the world in which we were born, the 80s being entirely defined by materialism mm-hmm. and by sort of switching our faith from things that were old or mysterious or spiritual. And again, it's a Christmas movie, so again, innately Christmas, the debate about around Christmas sort of that was perennial in the last several decades, was it becoming overly commercialized? So we have this spiritual holiday that is all awash in doohickeys and gadgets and all this other kind of stuff, and then everything starts to go awry at the same time, of course, that Mogwai are turning into gremlins, and it creates this fantastic backdrop for this movie that feels very, very rich, that again allows it to also be very breezy and fast. It's why we can just sort of begin in Chinatown and Hoyt Axton wants a unique gift. We get it. We understand modernity kind of sucks in certain ways. We want unique stuff. Mm-hmm. And he finds a Mogwai in the shop, mm-hmm. doesn't mm-hmm. he, Taylor?
Yes, he does.
Indeed.
And the best Mogwai around.
Oh, yeah. And the best, and Gizmo, the original Mogwai, mm-hmm. the old Mogwai, the original, is mm-hmm. the one that has the good heart, the good soul.
Yes,
it's
yes.
the cute thing. Whereas, as soon as he gets water on him, mm-hmm. When the careless Americans violate the very careful rules laid out by tradition,
yes.
when he gets water on him, the cheap knockoffs of Gizmo that quickly
yes.
get produced
yes.
clearly
yes.
are defective. They yes. are lacking yes. in yes. something that Gizmo has. We can't yes. quite put our finger in it,
yes.
but it's something
yes.
in the soul. It doesn't mm. really have the divine spark that mm-hmm. The original Gizmo had. And as soon as we see them, the focus of the little guy, of the cheap knockoffs, is immediately on technology. Mm-hmm. When we see at the Christmas tree, Gizmo is playing a horn, a traditional analog instrument, trying to create music in the Christmas spirit, whereas all the little cheap knockoffs all their attention is focused on like a video game or something,
yeah,
or a
like
pinball,
a
little pinball
something.
Machine
yeah,
or
yeah,
something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
And they're furiously fighting with each other over it and all that kind
mm-hmm.
of stuff. So yeah,
yeah,
they are. So yeah, perfectly tied in with all
yeah,
that.
No, that is a great, really fascinating thought. Just the idea that they are mass production, you know, and it, again, you just put a little bit of water on them and they grow, and they seem similar, but there is something seeded within them that ultimately grows into corruption and all of this other kind of stuff, and they actually are revealed to be devils. And so there's this idea that even all of these cute things that we have in our kitchen and in our home that are approximations, like our furniture, you know, our mass-produced furniture, our IKEA furniture, if you will, you know, that always is falling apart and breaking. I had three IKEA beds in a row that all broke within a year, and I would have collectively spent less had I bought one solid bed, which I ultimately did, than three different IKEA beds. But I kept coming back for that mass-produced cheapness, and it kept breaking. There was a gremlin, if you will, in my bed. Anyway, but I don't know, but there is this interesting idea that there is something like there is a devil, literally a mm-hmm. devil in these things that on the surface look like the old comfy, cozy, handmade furniture where a human being might have made something and put some part of his spirit and his love into it. And then you, when you use that object, that handmade knife or chair or whatever the thing is, you feel that intention as opposed to, yeah, but it's just an object. Why not roll off 50 of them? And then there you see the same, that spark, the ability to literally create even music. Mm-hmm. Gizmo sings, Gizmo has a heart, all these other things, is not present. And in that way, I guess it also is very similar to AI. People are it's like, oh, look, it looks just like a painting, or it looks just like a this, or look, this arrangement of words looks just like something that someone might write. And yet there's something in the middle. There's something hidden within AI, and if you listen close enough, you can almost hear when you are reading AI stuff or looking at AI art, you can almost hear dun 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 just creeping in, that little Jerry Goldsmith theme. Like, we don't know what is in this that's hidden in it, but it's something, and it's going to hatch eventually. And what is it? There is a devil in this machine, etc., etc., etc. And quite literally, you see the Mogwais transmute from something warm-blooded, that is to say, that looks superficially warm-blooded. He is furry, he has, you know, whatever, literally looks like a mammal, you know, to something that looks reptilian, something that is cold, something that no longer has a warmth in its blood. And, you know, that's, what is that but mass production? And I guess it's like, what you could go on and on about all of the levels at which the film resonates on a subtextual level and ignore the fact that at the same time, it's just still a rockin' kick-ass movie, you know, at the same time. And I think that on some level is the brilliance of the Spielberg and Amblin touch as he guided the film into having Gizmo in it, as he guided the film into several other things, as he seems to understand in a very deep way, and I think that resonated not only through his film, not discrediting Joe Dante, who made many brilliant films as well, but just saying there seems to be a guiding hand here that sort of understands this, that balance of masculine and feminine that we talked about with, like, when we watched Why Is Terminator, you know, so transcendently good. Like, you feel it even in the theater when we were watching it at the Alamo. You know, the fact is, I love Gremlins because it's a movie full of creepy, crawly monsters and all sorts of other shit, and special effects and shit that melts and funny Looney Tunes gags, and yet it still has a feminine heart, a soul that is embodied by Gizmo, and you could literally, just by listening to the audible register of the voices reacting to the parts where Gizmo, where everyone's stake in the film was. And I don't know, that is that thing where you can some, I think even Chris Columbus, something I was listening to, referred to it as making the film more, you know, audience friendly, but again, that's has a pejorative connotation to it, as opposed to kind of allowing the film to fully and kind of robustly meditate on an idea. And speaking of a gremlin in the machine, this little gremlin, our cat Parker, has decided to join the podcast. Hi, Mr. Parker. Would you like to get in our lap? Oh, hi, Mr. Man. There he is. Hi, Parker. If you're enjoying the video aspect of the podcast, no, Mr. Parker, you're going to stay in Taylor's lap. You can't get on the table today. Hi, Mr. Man. Anyway, but there he goes. Yeah. He eventually submitted to laying down. So what were we just talking about? Oh, yeah. So anyway, Joe Dante. Let's talk about that for a minute. One thing that I cannot think about Joe Dante, we cannot talk about Joe Dante without talking about my favorite thing to talk about, Roger Corman. As you can see behind us, we have Attack of the Crab Monsters, little poster card. But Joe Dante worked for a long time as an editor for Roger Corman. He had cut a lot of trailers and emerged from that world, directed Piranha and The Howling, which I think were both written by John Sayles, who, in another Kevin Bacon-y connection from last week's episode on Something Wild, John Sayles was in that movie as well. So there you go. So, Joe Dante directs this movie. Kind of the perfect guy. He would ultimately, later on in his life, even direct a literal Looney Tunes movie, Looney Tunes Back in Action, starring Brendan Fraser, a different era in his career, a different time. But but clearly a man who, like a lot of the filmmakers of that time, Robert Zemeckis, Steven Spielberg among them, loved Chuck Jones and loved all the cartoons of that time and was kind of incorporating that idea. Nowhere is that more evident than in the fantastic bar sequence where we see the gremlins sort of indulging and representative of every form of vice and indulgence of modernity. But it's also just this hilarious scene full of sight gags of them shooting each other. There's like two Daffy Duck style gags where one of them shoots the another one There's a whole Flashdance homage where the one gremlin is in leg warmers. So it literally, you know, gets up to the, you know, parody metatextual level with what's going on in that scene, which, again, not to again harp on meaning, is all the funnier when you think about the gremlins as just being the sort of corrupted heart of our mass media soaked vice-guzzling kind of culture. Mm-hmm. To see these weird, grotesque devils, you know, doing aerobics and drinking and partying and all of this other kind of stuff. So anyway, and enjoying movies. Mm-hmm. By the way, it's worth noting, because I don't want to forget about it later, that prior to the film, the trailer for the new Disney Snow White played, which is so very fun. And, you know, maybe there was a conscious hand at work behind that, but that trailer did just hit, so I think
seems like the trailer that, because along with that trailer, we saw trailers for lots of other kids' movies that are coming out. Yes. That's a new one. Yes, by that strange synchronicity, we happened to see Gremlins while a legit Snow White trailer happened to be playing, because it was that time.
Yes, it's interesting that also that trailer played with the trailer for, I think, a film called Legend of Ochi or something, which just looked very Scandinavian. It looked, I think it was A24, blah, 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 blah. Willem Dafoe, who is now works as an indentured servant to A24, is in the film hashtag save Willem Dafoe. We must liberate Willem Dafoe. He is A24 has been holding him prisoner for several years now. Anyway, but he's in it. But the legend. But again, a film which really the trailer, by the way, kind of seemed to catch the attention of the audience, because it had clearly at its center a big-eared, fuzzy little creature named Ochi, who was really interacting with the little girl in the center of the trailer. The extremely Scandinavian-looking weird little girl in the middle of the trailer. But the creature was cute, and it was practical, and it was fuzzy, and had big ears, and was clearly somewhat Gizmo-inspired. And then that trailer played in hot relief against the trailer for Snow White, wherein the one thing you would kind of have going for you in a Snow White movie would be small, adorable, cute things. You know, be that all sorts of little people or dwarves in fun costumes, like Time Bandits or like the Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. Or you would have at least some fun puppets or something like that. And instead, you had terrifying sort of plasticine CGI golems that vaguely resembled people and were planted firmly in the uncanny valley as all of the seven dwarves. And seeing that,
and CGI animals all around. I don't think we saw any actual physical cute things to be found.
You can't apparently you can't really work with animals anymore. Too costly. Because unfortunately, when you pay animals, you have to pay money to an animal trainer, and you can't just internally embezzle that money and pay that back to yourself through CGI artists. So unfortunately, there's just no more animals in movies. So, again, it was interesting to kind of contrast that soulless, weird thing with no animals and no life in it, and to look back, immediately experiencing a better time where Gizmo rose out of the box. Every ovary in the audience vibrated with intensity, like one of those egg stones in Temple of Doom, which also came out the same year and was a Spielberg movie and also had an Asian boy with a baseball cap in it. I'm connecting everything here. But all the ovaries began glowing white hot within the audience, and suddenly there were emotions and feelings that will never exist, unfortunately, I don't think, in anything that has computer generated deer in it. I mean, if you can't get a deer, I feel like it's weird the film can generate like 25,000 gigantic fictional CGI backdrops and sets and worlds and castles and God knows whatever the hell is, you know, we haven't seen Wicked yet, but I'm sure it's full of that. And yet, like, you couldn't have a deer. You couldn't point a camera at a real deer that was created by nature.
You point a camera at a deer just up the street here.
Yes, exactly.
Just a few streets up, we have random deer walking around occasionally by our house up a little north in Austin. They're around. You can find them.
But if you do that, it is harder for production companies to embezzle money. So we can't have that. Instead, it's all CGI deers. Anyway, but speaking of someone who hated all of the waste that in movies that was essentially just there as cover for embezzlement, Roger Corman. Roger Corman, who walked
never had enough money to embezzle nothing.
Exactly, exactly. So he, so Joe Dante emerges from that. And what I do dig about the movie is that the movie does have it's an interesting kind of fusion of the kind of Spielbergian Amblin sensibility and the kind of punk rock independent New World Pictures sensibility that Roger Corman cultivated. Like, it kind of pushes edges in provocative ways with what it's having done. It plays with what it basically it feels, as would clearly be the case, because it's grimy. And it's funny because we all think of the Gremlins as so cute, and it's funny to think of like Leonard Maltin disapproving of the film and thinking it's base and gross and all of these other things. But it is a schlocky monster movie. It's the kind of thing that Roger Corman made his bread and butter on during all of the years that people weren't actually making those kinds of movies. And so he puts this wonderful homage. I mean, there's a lot of fun actors. Harry Carey Jr. is in the movie, which I didn't realize until recently, playing one of the old men. But he puts Dick Miller in the movie. And as we have learned from the Terminator... Ah, there you go. That's the other thing. Also... Dick Miller was in The Terminator. Dick Miller is in this movie. He plays Mr. Futterman. Roger Corman, stock company regular. And opposite him is the original Audrey from Little Shop of Horrors from the 1960, whatever it was, 1959. Little Shop of Horrors is in the film playing his wife. So you
his
have
impossibly sweet wife.
His impossibly sweet wife. I do have to say, I think, you know, Dick Miller's greatest performance was in Bucket of Blood, which we talk about a lot. And he would have starred in Little Shop of Horrors, but he didn't want to kind of make the same movie a second time or whatever, and so he plays a smaller role, and they brought in what's his name from Teenage Caveman and stuff to play Seymour, and I forget his name. But Dick Miller's leading lady, Barbara Morris, I feel like would have been the Mrs. Futterman, but unfortunately she passed away when she was 43 years old. She was married to Monty Hellman, and I think maybe died of cancer or something. I have no idea how she died, but she was in Sorority Girl. She was in Wasp Woman. She's like the main other girl opposite Susan Cabin and Wasp Woman as well. She was fantastic, and she is like one of, again, Barbara Morris, one of the really underappreciated talents of that time. She just pops in every one of those movies. In Bucket of Blood, in Wasp Woman, she's the person you kind of can't take your eyes off of. And I kind of feel like now in watching, you know, Dick Miller and Jackie Joseph, who also came from that Roger Corman school, I wonder if in an alternate reality where Barbara Morris was still alive, if she would be in the movie instead. I don't know, but that's just something I think about sometimes in my own time, because I think a lot about Roger Corman movies. Anyhoozle. But anyway, it was a grimy, cool, slimy movie, as well as a big, fun studio movie, and it came out the same week as Ghostbusters. Cliff, comment on this.
Well, both movies were big hits, obviously, but I think Ghostbusters ultimately made more money, but Gremlins, it appears, was a had some legs the second weekend, made more money than the first. Yes. And as we kind of discussed earlier, no one knew what it was about. Everyone was surprised.
Yes. Oh, yes, that is something worth talking about. Yes, is that idea that the posters and things potentially somewhat concealed where the film went, and E.T. had made so much money that a lot of parents took their kids to go see Gremlins, unaware that they would become creepy, crawly gremlins and stuff. And that sounds like a wild, fun ride.
Heck yeah. It's the same kind of outrage that later Bart Simpson would face or Beavis and Butthead would face. Something that looks like it's for kids, but it's really naughty at its core. What's going on?
I was thinking more of like a parents Deadpool outraged. Toward like Modernia has Deadpool. Everyone thinks that Marvel is all kid-friendly, but Deadpool was not kid-friendly.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. No, it is, I don't know. It's Gremlins. It's a fantastic, thing. Joe Dante. Let's talk about Joe Dante a little bit more, because He made Explorers after this, which is a film that was unfortunately, I think, taken away from, not taken away, but from him in the editing room, but he had to release it faster than he wanted, and can carry, and has some fantastic effects by Rob Bottin. What are some of the other great Joe Dante movies, Cliff? Matinee was a latter
Matinee one. Matinee was fantastic. He directed the very Looney Tunes segment of the...
Twilight Zone
movie.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah. Anyway,
no actors killed in his, so he has that one up on John Landis.
Yes, that's indeed, indeed, yes, indeed. He does. Indeed, he does. Tragedy free. That his shoot.
But so. No, that's where his love for Looney Tunes is mm-hmm. most on Front Street, with a very, very Looney Tunes looking and premised. I don't know. Goofy thing in that movie.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
check
absolutely.
It out.
So back to dive into Gremlins here for a moment and kind of get away from Joe Dante. So one of the things that bugged me when I was a kid was that Judge Reinhold disappears from the movie. So only recently, only today, did we actually for the first time watch those deleted scenes where Judge Reinhold shows up in the film. And the film kind of works in this fantastic kind of small town. Mm-hmm. Film has a fantastic small town, backlot town at its center, which is actually, yes, the same backlot town as Back to the Future, with the same movie theater and all of that. And we have talked Back to the Future to death on several podcasts, and so it is a quite familiar. The town where
all
he reached...
All but the clock tower, I
exactly,
think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The town where they reached... The main street where they reached 88 miles per hour. But it has this fantastic little main street town where, as Billy Peltzer... Our protagonist makes it through his morning on his way to the bank. He meets a lot of several shitty characters, like Mrs. Deagle, the old lady, who eventually gets her comeuppance in the fantastic sequence when she's attacked by gremlins and gets launched by her, of course, technological doohickey. Mm-hmm, her the chair that elevates her up the stairs is electronically malfunctions and fires her like a cannon. Spectacular
right out that
sequence, yeah. But as much energy as is put into Mrs. Deagle, almost as much screen time is put into Judge Reinhold's character in the film, who plays the shitty bully character opposite Billy Peltzer, and who not only shows up and like, Peltzer, your dog is out of control when he attacks Mrs. Deagle, and then shows up to kind of best Billy in the bar scene afterwards and hit on Phoebe Cates. And so a tremendous amount of time and screen time is placed into clearly setting up a character who's going to get his just desserts in the end. And I'm sure his character has a name in the film, but we're just going to call him Judge Reinhold because that's who he is. And it's too confusing to call him anything else. But anyway, so then he disappears from the film entirely. He never comes back. I almost feel like when I was a kid and I saw him in the first part of the film, because, you know, when you're a kid, you kind of only live in the second that you're in and a couple seconds on either side. So I'm like, I'm sure he comes back later, but I did not have enough continuity of consciousness to ever really pay attention to it until I was an adult. But now we live in the age of YouTube, so we were able to watch the scenes. And so, among other things, what we discover, and I do want to talk about this because it really does take all of the subtext of the film and ground it in a and explicate it in a fantastic way, is that I think there's a subsequent scene where Judge Reinhold is, along with the bank manager, are reprimanding Billy for being 17 minutes late to work. And of course, Billy gets 17 minutes late to work because of the dog, and he's helping his family, and he stops to talk to Mrs. Futterman, and all of the things that constitute his relationship to the community don't matter, because the boss is all about time, he's all about quantification, he's all about modernity, etc. Only to then, later on, we return to the same set, the bank manager's office, which now I don't think is even seen in the film at all. We return to the bank manager's office, and Phoebe Cates leads Billy to look at secret plans, and all of the various characters in the film, including Dick Miller, the out-of-work Mr. Futterman, and others, including Billy's family, are going to have their houses foreclosed upon by Mrs. Deagle in a very It's a Wonderful Life-like conspiracy. And this is another part that I think is wonderful about this, is it definitely evokes more of the kind of Capra-esque, you know, It's a Wonderful Life shit where there's an evil banker in town who's going to foreclose on everyone's houses so they can sell Kingston Falls to the High Tox Chemical Company. It is interesting because this is like the third Joe Dante, would be like, because I think Piranha, it's like there's an evil chemical company or whatever that's taken over. I think it was the part that maybe worked the least well. It was all of that kind of stuff in Piranha. And then in The Howling, there's more of that about media and stuff. But the high, so it's interesting. It feels like it connects it a little bit to his earlier films. And I'm not sure how much of that, you know, was in the original Chris Columbus script or whatever. But this idea that the town itself is going to be consumed by presumably the, you know, a factory used for the byproducts of all of
mass
these
consumering.
All of the consumer plastic bullshit that we are now drowned, that you see the family drowning.
And that would literally poison us with the high toxicity of its byproducts.
Exactly. And all of this so that we can enjoy a life as we see in the film, where every time they interact with any piece of technology, either created by the Peltzers or not, it is breaking, it is complicated, it is fucking up in some way.
And of course the gremlins always kill people or do bad things through technology. Even though they have teeth and claws, they don't use the teeth and claws that much.
Which
mostly,
is, by the way, go ahead.
Continue. Well, yeah, when they have every opportunity to just munch on people's heads there, they instead fuck with some electronic thing that they would have no reason to know how to work or exist because they were only born like 5 minutes ago. But somehow they know. Understand technology.
Yep.
And even at the end of the movie, they don't even attribute it to the gremlin creatures. They just say freak accidents all around town and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Yes, no, that
mass delusion.
Yes, and that's sort of the interesting thing. And again, I've never read the original Chris Columbus script, but some of the sequences that were described were like the gremlins were literally just eating all the people inside of a McDonald's and stuff. You could see that as being a satire of contemporary culture, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, McDonald's, mass-produced food, the gremlins eat all the people, leave all the fast food. Very funny. But you are right. They are creatures with teeth and claws and all this other stuff. But by not making them critters, by not making them carnivorous creatures like in the movie Critters that, eat people, you got to do something else. It immediately creates a question of how are they going to interact with people? How are they going to fuck with people? And so it introduces that whole idea that they're going to be literal gremlins in all of the machines, and which again, yes, makes the film more family friendly than if they were literally eating people, but also makes it far richer subtextually than if they were just a movie about carnivorous demon devils that were eating a bunch of shit. Anyway, so just very, very, very cool.
They might have eaten the head of the chemistry teacher there. Who knows?
Exactly.
We never see his head.
Yes. And he's coming after
He does have the syringe in his butt, so that ties it to the technology.
I know. And they're coming after, he's coming after the Mogwai with an implement of the medical industrial complex, the syringe, and has it then turned against him. The scientific industrial complex gets him back, bites him in the end. But to not lose the thread of Judge Reinhold for a moment, what completes this arc is after we have discovered that the what's his dick is gonna turn the whole town into a toxic waste dump. They return to the bank manager's office one more time, where they find the bank manager laying on the ground, who has had his head smashed by a clock. A giant wall clock has been ripped off, speaking of the clock tower in Back to the Future. The clock that Billy was 17 minutes late on when he arrived to work has been used to smash the bank manager's head.
And in case you didn't know who he is, I believe his plaque has been stabbed into him.
There you go. Perfect. And again, so it's like that It's a Wonderful Life skit that they did on SNL. Remember back in the Dana Carvey days of SNL, where after they realize that it's the same ending, but after they realize that Mr. Potts or whatever Potter has stolen all the money, they're like, let's go kick that guy's ass, and everyone goes from it's an angel party, and they all just kick the shit out of Mr. Potter for a while. So it kind of actualizes that desire by having the gremlins just kick the shit out of Mr. Potter and smash his head. But what I do find beautiful is they give an ending to the Judge Reinhold character. They give an ending to him where they find that he has barricaded himself in to the bank vault. And they say, well, where are the keys? You know, how can we get Billy and Phoebe Cates, co-starred with Judge Reinhold in Fast Times at Ridgemont High? We finally get a sequel to see what happened to his creepy character after he was spying on her boobs from the bathroom window in that movie. So he has locked himself into the bank vault. They ask him, you know, hey, where are the keys? How can we get you out of here? And he doesn't want to give them the keys because he, now that the main bank manager is dead, he believes that he is now king of the bank and is suspicious that they want to get into his safe space too. And so he starts ranting, paranoid about how he won't let them into his bank vault, and they slowly close the bank vault door on him and then move on and leave him ranting and crazy inside, which is, again, a fantastic end. And what better end could you have to the guy who, again, was this kind of scumbag guy who's trying to sell Billy out, who presumably is his friend and coworker, to try and advance himself.
It's like alluded to that they were like high school friends or something.
So that he can advance himself up the ladder of the bank. And he ultimately, not unlike Burgess Meredith in that Twilight Zone episode, who has no people and all the books, etc., he's left with all the money, but in a chaotic world where all of that. And again, that's, I don't know. So that's, and what's cool is that I like that as an ending for him. And I just like the idea that gremlins just represent chaos in the film, that they are just madness, that there are people. And I think that there are certain times when epochs of order in American life, you know, the 50s, the 80s came back. The 50s were really coming back in the 80s. That was our decade. The idea of, you know, and 50s, we've talked about it that on the podcast, I think, before. We grew up in a soup of 50s nostalgia, 50s music, movies set in the 50s with people with square haircuts and all sorts of stuff. But into these epochs of order, chaos. The pendulum swings the other way. There is a devil in the machine, etc., etc. And in a weird way, I think that is what makes this current moment, as opposed to even the 90s when we grew up, which was sort of an epoch of sort of the return of certain chaotic elements, at least in culture, music, etc., though it was just to cover up the fact that the world of the new world order was really taking over,
finally taking power.
That's right, exactly. It was all fucking bullshit. But and I might need to go plug in my laptop here in a minute because I forgot to plug it in before and we're running out of batteries. But what was I just talking about? Oh yes, but just the idea that we are now also in this time where there was sort of an oppressive and kind of just emergent order of social media, iPhones, technology sort of eclipsing all life, then into which chaos has in the last 5 years been introduced. And now we are seeing people attempting to reconnect spiritually to other things, go beyond mass-produced culture, return to handmade things, return to living in nature. People are kind of rejecting, I think there's even studies showing that the next generation of high school students are largely rejecting smartphones. In part, not in mass, but in part, and switching back to lower forms of technology because they realize that there is a devil in the gizmo. There is a mogwai.
No one can avoid it now. Yes. Everyone sees the gremlins in the machines that have been there all along but are now causing chaos.
And that
everywhere.
They are Chinese.
They were on to the Chinese all
that's
along.
That's right. That's right. All right. Quick, Cliff, talk about gremlins while I plug in the laptop at the same time.
Yes. What have we not talked about? Let's see. Taylor, what was your favorite part of the screening?
I am trying to kind of reflect. I think my favorite part was a lot of kids were in the audience. It was probably a lot of times
that was very
first,
fun.
You know, viewing of
definitely
the Gremlins.
Got the vibe that was a lot of kids, a lot of people seeing it for the first time, and it was great to see how big their reactions were.
For sure.
And the tittering afterwards,
and you know that it still is holding up when brand new eyes are still enthralled with the movie and whatnot, or enthralled with all the scenes, or you know, making sure that everyone's getting out alive at the end. And so that was really, really fun. And just kind of as an adult looking at a couple of the scenes and kind of thinking about the special effects aspect of it, I think a big part of these older movies are the special effects are just very entertaining and still hold up a lot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Specifically in mind, I'm thinking of when Gizmo first gets wet and has all the little cotton balls popping out from his mask. Yeah. Like, I still don't quite know how they got that to happen, but that's part of the fun.
Can you imagine having grown up just in a world of kind of CGI soup?
Oh, good lord.
Yeah, where just nothing feels real and and then suddenly seeing real creatures.
Real for the first time.
Yes. Feeling real and tangible. And you could feel...
And it would last a hell of a lot longer. People are watching this 30, mm-hmm. 40 years later, however long it was. People are not going to be watching the new Snow White 30 or 40 years from now. Not in unironic ways, anyway.
Yeah, no, I think there is something, and this will sound really weird, but there is something that is there is something innately textual about CGI. And I think that is why it rose in the era of the kind of producer-writer-driven streaming TV and everything, that CGI tells you that there's a giant monster there. See, there is one. I've told you it's there because you see it is there, but you don't actually feel it as being there. I mean, you can. It does work. It works in Jurassic Park. It works
if you have really good actors.
Yeah, talented directors who know what they're doing can make it work.
They can make it work, but I also think there's a tremendous amount of artistry in the CGI of Jurassic Park, so you feel a humanity and an intention as opposed to all of these sort of algorithmically driven monsters with all of their weird tentacles and orchid faces that have occupied cinema for the last several years. You can feel you can feel a human hand at work, even if the medium they're working through is a CGI sculpture as opposed to a claymation sculpture. However, CGI these days seems to just textually inform you that a world exists, whereas when you actually create the thing for real, a real gizmo, a real set, a real special effect, even if that special effect is highly augmented with the removal of men in blue suits and rods and all sorts of other stuff, you could feel it in the audience when watching it today. There is a visceral, emotional, animalistic reaction to the reality of that thing that just doesn't seem to exist. This seems tangibly more potent in the theater than it does even when with Rocket Raccoon or some other...
Yeah.
You know, like Rocket Raccoon is a fun idea of a character. Rocket Raccoon is cool. Taylor loves Guardians of the Galaxy. And there's lots of cute stuff, even with Baby Groot transcending culture.
Mm-hmm.
But even Baby Groot feels rather watered down compared to the visceral reaction that people had in its own time and now to Gizmo.
Real creature.
Yes.
And I've also I think Baby Groot is so cultivated because they're given scenes specifically to be oodled and cute. Like, so the coming to mind is like the credit scene of like Baby Groot like dancing in his pot. Oh my God, he's so cute. Yeah. I'm going to buy a little pot where he's dancing.
I agree. That's actually a good point, in that a lot of what makes Baby Groot special is something textual rather than actually visual
Whereas Gizmo,
tangible.
I was scared every time he was in pain. You better put him down. Oh my God, my little baby.
It requires an entire film to create an idea of Groot and Rocket Raccoon so that then onto this small plasticine CGI golem we can now we sort of project this whole heart, and Groot, who is giant, is now being reborn, and he's tiny, and it's cute. All of this other kind of stuff. Whereas Gizmo just needs to emerge from a box. Literally, it's all he has to do. We were listening to Chris Wallace, the special effects guy, a little bit talk about the fact that, and I really love this story just because it's somewhat heartwarming to hear that, you know, he slaved over this thing, making Gizmo. It was his baby. It was full of all sorts of stuff. He operating it, trying to make it work, etc. And he finally said he waited to see the full movie with an audience, and then he saw the movie with an audience, and he said his heart was pounding in his chest as Gizmo emerged from the box, and he's like, is it gonna work, and he said the entire audience went oh, as we have experienced them still doing 40 years later.
It's the best.
And he said his exact words were, it felt like I was in heaven. And I really do like that. So it's again, there's just something that is very tangible about all of that, and I was going somewhere with that. But oh yeah, Chris Wallace, funny enough though, was not available for Gremlins 2, which is why they brought on Rick Baker to make all of the crazy Gremlins. Other people have told that story, but what I like is that Chris Wallace was not available to direct Gremlins 2. I don't think it's wrong though, because he was directing The Fly 2 at the time, because he also did the special effects for The Fly, and so he directed The Fly 2, which, if you haven't seen The Fly 2, it's I think the final version of the script was written by Frank Darabont, who did the rewrite.
It's solid. It was not a huge hit, but it's solid. Yeah, starring Eric Stoltz.
Yes. Makes a good Frank Darabont writer triple feature with Dream Warriors and The 88 Blob. So anyway, but really, really fantastic Gremlins, obviously, fantastic effects, etc. And but my God, like if you think about the same movie, all of the same things, a good horror movie, a good horror comedy,
yeah.
but without that heart at the center of it. We actually just watched on Joe Bob last night, we watched rewatched Rare Exports, which even though it is very Scandinavian in a lot of ways.
I was texting your sister about that actually. You should go check this out. It's really good.
Which we hadn't seen since it played Fantastic Fest, like way back in 2010, but it has a movie about evil Santas and evil Santa elves and all this stuff, but at its heart it still has a kid and his relationship to his father. That is what our hearts are clinging to the whole time. And I think that there's a lot of films that understand the creepy crawliness, and they especially films by largely, you know, young.
And I'll even throw out, not to cut you off,
no,
but I think a fun aspect of the movie, while small, is that the kid does worry about whether he is on the naughty or nice list, or there's more of a, pretense or more emphasis on whether or not a kid is naughty or nice, which I think is not usually. I mean, obviously Santa has his naughty or nice list and blah blah blah. You want to have a gift for Christmas, but there was a little bit more of a scary aspect to you know whether or not you were a naughty or a nice kid. You know, getting the lashings.
Oh, you're talking about Rare Exports.
I'm still
like, for some reason my mind is toggling back to Gremlins.
No, we're still with Rare Exports.
I was like, where was that in Gremlins? I don't know. It's because you're wearing a Gremlins sweatshirt. I'm like right back to Gremlins. No, Rare Exports is really cool. I liked. It's a cool movie. So if you haven't seen Rare Exports, Scandinavian Christmas horror movie, very, very cool. But it's the kind of thing that, yeah, Rare Exports, there seem to be a lot of films that understand the creepy crawly aspects of these movies, but not a lot of films that understand the heart aspect. And I think that that is that Amblin touch. And it's interesting. Yeah, was it the same year as Terminator? 84?
84, yeah, 84 would be the year.
Yeah, good year for Dick Miller.
Oh, yeah.
But again, and we have
does make it out of Gremlins.
He does make it out. That's right.
He makes it all the way to Gremlins 2, but he's not even killed in Gremlins, noticing it in the theater with the clear sound.
Yes,
in the radio broadcast.
In the radio
he is being interviewed.
Yes, that's
after
right.
After the accident, so we know he made it.
Yeah, no, that's what I do like. That as a kid, I remember we're like, it's bullshit. He kind of dies, but then he comes back. But of course, we didn't think it was bullshit because we love Dick Miller in Gremlins 2. But as it turns out, yeah, it is totally not. It is totally set up there in the movie that he is still alive at the end. The real Don Steele plays the DJ, the LA DJ featured prominently in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood throughout all of the radio broadcasts and everything.
My theory, they went through the window. You see, we see the gremlins hit the wall and, you know, clearly impact the wall where the Futtermans were standing, but between them was the window. My thought is Mr. Futterman grabs Mrs. Futterman, or the other way around.
Yes.
Who knows? And they jump out the window, the gremlins hit the thing. Bumps, bruises, scrapes, but otherwise they run to some kind of safety.
Yeah, they have a bandage over their head to show that they're injured, but okay.
I like it. What is it? Kentucky Harvester. That's a Kentucky Harvester. You know, it's like not this foreign craft.
Shout
constantly
out Kentucky.
Breaking down. Yeah, that's right. Taylor was born in Kentucky. That's right. Kentucky Harvester. Yeah. So because this film balances masculine and feminine so well, I think as a way of wrapping things, beginning to wrap things up, we can speculate as to the meanings of Gremlins, but here in this Christmas season, so that we know what lessons Gremlins may impart to our audience, we must consult the spirits. We must consult the gremlins, if you will, the ghosts in the machine. And speaking of the ghosts in the machine, who we're not supposed to get wet, it just started raining outside as I began this. Hold on one second.
We're taking a brief rain break.
No, we're not taking a brief rain break.
No, okay, we're taking
a tarot shuffling break.
No, it's not a tarot shuffling break. I put my mic down for a second, but yes. So we did a tarot draw. Taylor, turn over the card. What does Gremlins have to tell us this week?
Right side up.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Well, we literally, it's so funny. We were just talking about the film that balances. It is the Six of Pentacles. We're talking about a film that balances the masculine and feminine, and the Six of Pentacles is quite literally a card of balance, as it shows a merchant holding a scale. That is why this is also the card of Libra, and I am, and I know this because I am a Libra. But it holds him.
And it is balanced also, like the six-sided star, two equal equilateral triangles facing in opposite directions.
Yes, exactly. And so this is also, though, a film about, a card about discernment, as if you notice, he is holding his scale and he is giving to one of these two beggars in the triangle, but not giving to the other two beggars, the other beggar. And that... is interesting, because you can kind of see, potentially, you can write whatever story you want around the tarot card. Is he ultimately going to give to both or just one? I think what we see in Gremlins, as we saw in some of the other transcendent films of that period, be it E.T., Gremlins, or The Terminator, is the balance of this masculine and feminine. Terminator in Sarah Connor's love for Kyle Reese, and finally pregnancy by the end of the film. In Gremlins, the idea of this sort of chaos and darkness sort of emerging into our world of modernity, and wrestling with the idea that there is a devil in all of our world of devil hidden in our world of technology and order. So we see here a choice is being made, not only where in our lives are we going to put that balance? Are we going to invest ourselves into the world of technology and into the world of money? Because again, we literally have a merchant. It is the suit of Pentacles, who is weighing out money, just like I want to keep calling him Billy, because he's Billy in he's
Mr. Speak, Cat.
See, this is a perfect example.
We have a real life gremlin with big ears interfering with our technology podcast.
Exactly. Here we are with all these, it's just literally trapped in a spider's web of cables and wires, and this little gremlin and wants to pull it all apart. Hi, Mr. Man.
There
I love
he
you.
Goes. Maybe. Yeah.
Anyway, so as you go about this Christmas season, just like Billy Peltzer and the rest of the Peltzer family, where are you going to put your finger on the scale? Where are you going to put your dollars and cents, your emotional calories, etc.? Are you going to invest in the veil of Maya? Are you going to invest in the material world where all is grown on tears? Or are you going to invest in things that are transcendent and spiritual, like family, like the spirit of the season, and all of that other stuff? So,
symbolized by Gizmo.
Exactly, symbolized by Gizmo. Are you going, that is a good point, are you ultimately going to be a Christmas gremlin or a Christmas Gizmo? So
Mogwai.
A Christmas Mogwai, if you will. And so put a little devil in your Christmas with
Gremlins.
And now, final thing before we wrap up. Cliff, who was the most, the Full Metal Jacked Award, who was the most jacked person, the most muscular person in Gremlins?
It's impossible to say because, of course, we see no one with their shirt off or anything. But I'll have to give it, I guess, to the chemistry teacher, because I assume he had a trim cut, so I assume that...
But what about Hoyt Axton, the father? He is an enormous man with an
enormous head. True. Certainly not Jack, but he would definitely throw the hardest punch of anybody in the movie. He could deliver the knockout blow.
Yes.
So you may be right. It's a tie. It's a tie.
Yes.
Between
the fittest
and least fit man in the men in the movie.
Then again, Spike is pretty ripped, you know, in his own way.
He's
got tiny little sinewy muscles. He does have a little six pack. You're right.
No, that is right. Forget the humans. They are out of it.
You see them with their shirts off. They never have. Actually, they do have shirts at certain points.
The winner will have to be the Gremlins / Spike, the hero Gremlin puppet with the abs. The only person in the movie with abs. So
fantastic.
There you go.
Fantastic.
Where's that fan fiction?
You know what? It probably exists. It's like he's like, sometimes he's a Mogwai, but sometimes he's a gremlin. But I love both sides of him.
But I see the Mogwai within.
That's right. All right. Well, as the rain begins to pour even harder outside, don't get them wet. Don't feed them after midnight. And don't show them bright lights. And we will see you in a crowded theater. Until next week, y'all. Bye.
See you next week.